I had seen a signature of the mother, the abstract version which she drew herself of a bird with wings facing down, and she called it the bird of peace descending on earth. Not the bird of bliss, the bird of peace. And the great sage Ramana Maharshi said, the state of equanimity is the state of bliss. As simple a word as equanimity. In daily living, not as a philosophy, not as a theory, not me reading out passages from the Bhagavad Gita and talking about them. In about half an hour, I shall attempt to share with you a way of seeing relationships, because daily living is about relationships. We cannot escape that. If we have a practice, whether it is a meditation practice, whether it is yoga, if we have a daily practice, but the rest of the day is a mess because we can't handle people, we are in conflict with others or ourselves, then it is a fragmented practice. Therefore, the great saying, all life is yoga. And it is as far as relationships are concerned that we need the most healing. If relationships are healed, we are at peace. But unfortunately, not only are we not at peace, but we tend to disturb or destroy others' peace by what we say and what we do. So, to begin with, when a child is born, the universe takes care of the child through the presence of the mother, and the mother provides milk to the baby. The child is pure being and is supported by the universe. That is our simple beginning that we all share, otherwise we wouldn't be here. Now, by and by, this baby starts realizing that an object apart from itself is there. And as time goes by, the baby realizes, if I cry, this object comes running. This is the birth of the ego into the world of form, forms separate from me. And by the age of a year and a half to 2 years, this separation has set in. What was pure being, which is known as the Bal Krishna state, the purity of pure being, has become the ego, which is identification with name and form as a separate entity. I am given a name. When people call out my name, I respond. So this form has been given a name, which is me, and my battle for life has begun. And this ego is now conditioned by the parents, by the geographical location, by the religion, by the economic status of the parents, and it starts growing up through the journey of life. This is me. And all that I say, all that I think, and all that I do is based on two factors: my genetics and my conditioning. This is everyone's experience, the separate me. So any decision I make in life, because life is about making decisions all the time, are based on two factors not created by me. That is how precious my decision is. That is how precious I think it is. Now, everyone I meet on the journey of life, family, friends, colleagues at work, are all shaped by their genetics and their conditioning, neither of which were created by them. So who created everyone's nature? Some call it God. Others who are not comfortable with the word God say consciousness, the source, many words. Whichever suits us, we are comfortable, we can take it. But the fact remains that in our lives, especially the people we don't like, especially the people who push our buttons the most, are instruments of God, are instruments of the same source as much as we are. This is a fact. Hard to digest, but it is a fact. And my teacher would use this example of the gadgets in a kitchen, where each gadget is designed a certain way to bring about a certain output. The toaster will produce toast, the juicer will produce juice, the microwave will heat the food. But without electricity, they are all dead objects. Each instrument is designed for a certain role. Do we expect the toaster to produce juice? But when it comes to human beings, we want people to be a different way from what God has made them. We don't realize that our perspective is limited by our genetics and conditioning. That is the illusion, that is the Maya. And therefore, the ego is quick to call the other person wrong. Your view is wrong, my view is right. Who said? Did God come down and say your view is right? Your view is right based on your background, your filters, your nature. This needs to be really understood, and it's quite simple when one gets it. Because what happens is a slight shift takes place in a relationship. You are no longer wanting to prove that the other is wrong and you are right. That's what happens. You say, all right, that's your view. In this case, my view is different. So you agree to disagree without being disagreeable. That's what happens. Your job is not to convince anyone, because you have seen the game of life for what it is. We all are on the chessboard of life playing different roles. The friend, the antagonist, the lover, all are appearances in consciousness. And we have stuck labels on people's foreheads. And we say, this guy is my friend. I like him. This guy I don't like at all. And the sense of separation gets so strong. The sense of judging people, condemning people, hating people. Hatred, malice, jealousy, ill will, spite, condemnation. This heavy burden that we carry, not realizing that it is the same consciousness functioning through everyone. The same electricity is functioning through everyone. Otherwise, we'd all be dead right here, right now. The fact that y'all are conscious and I am conscious truly means we are instruments who are conscious. Consciousness is speaking through this instrument and listening to that instrument. If in either case it was absent, one of us would be dead. So it appears that individuals are listening and individuals are speaking. But when we realize that it's this electricity, the same energy running through all of us, then the game is quite over. Not as a theory, but as a fact. Would you condemn someone if you realized they are doing things and saying things based on the way God created them? How do we know what their childhood was like? Whether there was abuse, whether there was poverty, whatever it may be. We don't know where people come from. People don't know where we come from. So where's the question of judging someone? In a talk I gave 2 days ago, I said the same thing. Supposing you are arguing with someone, the topic of death came up, and you suddenly had an intuition the person in front of me is going to die in 1 hour. Wouldn't you rather that person live that 1 hour in peace or in arguing with you? And why is all this conflict there in life? Because I guard my position. My opinion is so precious to me. How dare you say something which is different from what I am saying? The ego simply does not want to die. And yet, it is everyone's experience that deep sleep is the most peaceful. Otherwise, we would not get up and say, I slept well. And the joke is, you were completely absent in deep sleep. You and your problems and your opinions and your judgments were absent in deep sleep. Which means your absence in deep sleep is the presence of peace. Your absence of the individual with its story of life is the presence of presence, which is right here, right now. So this teaching, which is based on the Indian philosophy of Advaita, is quite simple. If you accept the design of duality, which we are all part of, left and right, up and down, front and back, rich and poor, me and the other, is the design of duality. This is a life of duality. Polaric opposites of every conceivable kind. But what has happened is what was simply me and the other has got corrupted, distorted to me versus the other. It's my way or the highway. What was the natural framework in which we are going to live from birth to death has become a fight. And that is why the American healer Joel Goldsmith said, lay your sword down. My teacher would call it live the life courageous. It's too easy to blame someone. It's too easy to hate someone. With each day, all the people you meet during the course of the day, even the stranger on the road, if you meet them with this understanding, what would generally arise is compassion. So, what happens when we live life with this basic understanding? The eye of wisdom opens up, the so-called abstract third eye. Is this, instead of seeing through the physical eyes, you're seeing through the eye of wisdom. It is as simple as that. The third eye of Shiva is this. The eye of singularity, the eye of even vision. And I then go through a beautiful process. Earlier, I was observing people, judging them. Now, with this understanding, observing turns to witnessing. I start witnessing more and more. The play of creation, the drama of life, is witnessed on the screen of consciousness. I find, by and by, that knee-jerk reactions based on unconscious behavior now turn into responses. I tend to now see where the other person is coming from, what could be bothering him or her so much. And then I respond because the sting of doership has been pulled out from the equation. If everyone is acting out a script based on their nature, conditioning and genetics, as it is said in the Bhagavad Gita, who is truly the doer of the actions? It's as simple as this. Can one really hang someone for being the doer of their actions. This teaching of non-doership, which is the core of the Bhagavad Gita, even Sri Aurobindo has mentioned this time and again, is simply this. Live your life knowing that although in this dream of life we have to do things, truly we are not doing it, and nor are others. So when the sting of doership is pulled out from this equation, we find a deep peace because there are no others to hate anymore. And that is why in the Gita, the most famous scene where Arjuna has to kill those before him, and he tells Krishna, look here, I can kill everyone. Whoever's on the other side, family, friends, people I know, no problem. But I can't kill my preceptors. And so I refuse to fight. And he puts his bow and arrow down. I'm done. I refuse to fight. And Krishna tells Arjuna, look here. You were born in a warrior family. You were trained to be a warrior all your life. Your entire path has been a training for this point, which will determine the course of destiny. And now you think you are the doer of your actions, and it is up to you whether to kill or not. But don't worry, because I, as time, have already killed them, and you are the instrument through whom the killing will happen. Those are the final teachings in the Gita. So how many people are we killing and crucifying in our daily lives? Criticizing. Nisargadatta Maharaj said to criticize anyone is to criticize the affairs of Brahman. Are you criticizing God's creation? Do you know better? What's the point? Simple as that. This ego critic drops away with this basic understanding. Who am I to criticize what's going on? I may have a view, which I may express. No harm in that. I may have a preference based on my nature. But does that mean that I criticize others for the way God has made them? I remember something, a very fickle incident, you may call it. I was with two friends at a restaurant, and at a distant table was a woman wearing a lovely dress. So one friend told the other friend, and me as well, what a beautiful blue dress she's wearing. And the second friend said, it's not blue, it's green. And he said, no, it's blue. And the other friend, no, it's green. No, it's blue. No, it's green. And this went on for all of 5 minutes. And I said, look here, can we just establish it's a pretty dress first? Secondly, to you it looks blue, to you it looks green. Where's the problem? So this absolute position which we take on anything, if we take an absolute and extreme view on anything in life, we have already created the polaric opposite. Because you see, we are sitting on a pendulum which is pulled to one end and passing our judgment here. It's going to swing all the way to the other. And that's what our life just goes by like this. But if we really walk Buddha's middle path, no extremes. If someone says this, you are right. If someone says this, you are also right. My teacher mentioned an incident. He was the bank manager of the Bank of India. Very powerful position, big clients. And one day, one of the biggest bank account customers came very distressed to him and said, sir, I have a personal problem to discuss, no business, but I look up to you and your sense of fairness and balance. So he said, sure, what is it? And this man started criticizing his wife. Now, the bank manager being a bank manager, told his client, "You're absolutely right. I'm so sorry. You're absolutely right." And his client was very happy and left. And my teacher was relieved. And the next day, the secretary tells my teacher, "Sir, I think we have a problem because the man's wife has come." And he said, "All right." So she came in. She said, "Sir, my husband really looks up to you, praises you all the time, and we have some problems at home. So can I discuss them in confidence?" He said, "Sure." And she said, "My husband is like this. My husband is like that." And he kept saying, "You are right, ma'am. You are so right. You are so right." And she was very happy and she left. So in the evening, my teacher went home, poured himself a drink, and told his wife, "You can't believe what happened in the last 2 days. The biggest client came, complained about his marriage, and I kept saying, 'You are right, you are right, you are right.' And he was very happy. And the next day, the wife came, and I kept saying, 'You are right, you are right, you are right.' She was very happy." So my teacher's wife looked at him and said, "How could you tell both of them you are right?" And my teacher looked at his wife and said, "You are right." You see, it cuts this waste of the thinking mind. What this teaching does is it dissolves the thinking mind, which is either going into the dead past all the time or into an imaginary future. Now, when the thinking mind is dead, either you are in the present moment, and if there is work to be done, you are 100% with the work. But this world we live in, this thinking mind world, cartwheels upon cartwheels upon cartwheels, this teaching is slow poison for the thinking mind. It's going to die. And the death of the thinking mind is the birth of pure presence. Whatever comes up before you is honored for what it is, a symbol of consciousness, of God, whatever it may be. Nothing is rejected. My relationships, not only with people, with what transpires in my life, pleasure or pain. For most of us, few pleasures, many pains. It's the acceptance of what the present moment brings. Thereafter, I do what I can to mitigate the pain, but I don't create psychological pain over the primary pain by all what if, what should be, what could be scenarios. If I had done that, that would have happened. If I had not done that, that would not have happened. All these imaginary trajectories the mind goes into come collapsing down because they are based on doership. Either we take all our relationship problems to our grave, or we resolve them in this incarnation, because all relationships are ultimately our relationships with ourselves. Why? Simply because if I condemn someone, that condemnation, while it appears is on someone else, is coming up in my own consciousness. If you choose any word right now, let's say the word thief, calling someone a thief, that word thief is in your own consciousness. It's not apart from you. So what is the content of your consciousness right now? What words are part of your consciousness? What labels are part of your consciousness right now? Are they words of separation, judgments, opinions? It's all within you. I am within you. My voice is within your consciousness. It appears I'm apart from you. Is anyone outside of your consciousness? Is anything outside of you? Your parents inside you, colleagues at work inside you, governments inside you, because they are not out of your consciousness. There is nothing that can be outside your consciousness. The sun is not outside your consciousness. The space around the sun is not outside your consciousness. Because you are conscious, everything is within that consciousness. So what is really apart from you? That is how intimate life is. The beggar on the street is part of your consciousness. The billionaire is part of your consciousness. Because you are conscious of them. My mother had a guru who was a judge. And he had to pass some very harsh sentences. And when he was passing the harshest of sentences, after passing the sentence, he would get up from his chair, walk up to the criminal in the dock and give him a hug, and come back in his chair and continue performing the role of the judge. And one thing which I keep saying, the person you hate the most, the family member who you don't get along with, the one who pushes your buttons, are your greatest teachers. They are doing you a favor because all your reactions are being drawn out from within you. That is the favor they are doing, playing your enemy. Hard to digest. So by and by you find, I'm more at peace now. Less agitated than I used to be. You might find that people tell you, hey, something has changed. You're not as reactive as before. You appear to be more calm. It seems you're in the flow. You find people are drawn to that peace. New people maybe. Maybe family members who earlier were not close to you are now coming around. It works in mysterious ways, this whole thing called peace. An aura of peace. What is that? When the thinking mind is not functioning, that is peace. It's as simple as that. You don't have to do anything to get peaceful. The death of the thinking mind is the birth of wisdom, which is peace. People will tell you. It is everyone's experience. If I place two chairs before you, and one I put someone at peace, and one I put someone extremely agitated in the mind, you are bound to be drawn to the person who looks to be at peace. It is within you. That is the aura of peace. You are bound to be drawn to it because peace is your natural state. That sense of being which the baby had is going to be with you till your last breath. But the ego came and sat on top of it and veiled it through the journey of life. That peace which you sense in deep sleep is there. But once again in the waking state, this ego came with its sense of doership and identification. This is me and my story. It came and sat upon that peace. And so much for one story of life. What is its worth? Not only when we are dead is it gone, but in deep sleep it is gone. So next time we have an opinion which we want to force down on other people, it's an invitation to think twice. Hey, look here. Express it. We all must express our views and opinions. But don't be so strongly identified with it, because that will not only disturb your peace, but others' peace. Let them free. Let people free the way God has made them. You do your bit to the best of your ability. Another practical example I gave is at work. I had a staff member who was underperforming all the time, and the supervisor was getting frustrated and started abusing this staff member in subtle ways. You're not good enough. You're not this, you're not that. And it reached a break point. And so I called the supervisor. I said, look here, this person is doing the job to the best of their ability, the ability God has given. If he could have done more, he would have done more. You've told him umpteen times. But does this mean, because he's not conforming to your definition of best, that it becomes abuse? Is that quite fair? You have to decide as a supervisor and tell this person that if you don't meet so and so criteria, then we might have to ask you to leave. That's it. But where has this equation got corrupted? Where you have to talk like this to another human being? Is it really called for? You decided what his best should be, or did God? And then this supervisor told me, with tears in his eyes, he said, I know no other way, because in my previous job, not only was I abused by the supervisor, but my chair used to be kicked by him. At least I didn't do that. Conditioning. That's what happens. Someone else I met, terrible relationships with women. Always looking for the right relationship, never able to find. One day we sat down and I asked him about his childhood. And sure enough, what did he say? He and his two brothers. He said, when we were young and our mother started climbing the stairs up to our bedroom, we used to shake. We used to tremble because she would come up with a belt to whip us. And I told him, all this while you feel you have been a failure at your relationship with women, but look where you're coming from. You are truly not to blame. Imagine, for a child, the parents are God. They look after the child. And this is the equation you had with your mother. What do you think would happen with women? Your whole conditioning has been one of fear, abuse. So you are not able to translate this into your relationships. Maybe see a therapist. Maybe understand for yourself the dynamic and what's going wrong. But don't, for heaven's sake, blame yourself. I am not worth it. I am not good enough. What is wrong with me? Nothing is wrong with nobody. That is why I say all our imperfections are perfectly placed. Because we didn't create our imperfections. Nor did others. We truly didn't create it. So, this understanding makes this living dream of life more easy to navigate. This simple new way of looking at things as they are, not as they should be, not as they could be, means you accept the will of the divine. When you accept others for who they are, you accept yourself for who you are. That is how it works. When I reject others for who they are, I'm rejecting myself for who I am. In the Indian scriptures, it is said that all our breaths, the number of breaths we take in this incarnation, is predetermined. Now the point is, how many of those breaths are going to be agitated breaths and how many are going to be peaceful? And finally, when I don't condemn individuals, label them, my relationship has shifted from individual to individual to consciousness to consciousness. When I no longer see individuals except as a mechanism of daily living, when every time something happens, I remember the same electricity animates all the objects. My relationship is with God. Isn't that the ultimate bhakti? If I accept everyone as God's creation, that is bhakti. It doesn't mean I have to hug everyone. I may have preferences, the way I am made. But I accept everyone, totally, completely, as a child of God. I do what I have to do in a given situation. Especially if I don't like what's happening. But thereafter, I leave the results to God. It ends there for me. And then what greater offering to God than a pure vacant consciousness devoid of the drama of life? Then I find that my meditation is throughout the day. Why? Because true meditation, as a wise man said, is the witnessing of whatever arises in the day as movements in consciousness. True meditation, not as a practice, is the witnessing of whatever arises throughout the day as movements in consciousness. And this finally brings us to the definition of love, the most misunderstood word. Because all forms of love are conditional. One mother asked Ramakrishna, "I have unconditional love for my child. I know what unconditional love is." He said, "Certainly not. Unconditional love is when you love all mothers' children as much as you love your child. Because you've already conditioned it. When you say you have unconditional love for your child, you don't have it for someone else's child. The condition is already placed. So unconditional love is love without conditions. If I make no conditions upon you during the day, whoever you may be, it's unconditional love. I make no conditions. So we see, if we can live this life courageous, day by day, with anyone and everyone. Yogananda said that you think people are strangers, but even the person you cross on the street, you are in relationship with, the stranger. Whether you frown, whether you smile, or whether you ignore that person, that has to be seen. That is called conscious living. I'd like to end by reading four lines of Sri Aurobindo's words. The Lord is there equally in all beings. We have to make no essential distinctions between ourselves and others. The wise and the ignorant, friend and enemy, man and animal, and saint and sinner. We must hate none, despise none, be repelled by none, for in all we have to see the one disguised or manifested at his pleasure, not ours. Thank you for coming.
If this teaching has helped you experience more peace in your daily living and you feel inspired to support it, you can visit the Support the Teaching link on gautamsachdeva.com. You can also join the mailing list to stay updated on the latest talks, retreats, and other events.